And hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm possibly going to finish the novel that I've been reading now for about 3 months now, titled Ringer. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Cozy. And then it's Auntie Maggie and her five nephews and nieces. First Night of Howler Garden. Mama's Sleeping Scarf. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Angela's Glacier. So, it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Cozy. Storms rolled over the tundra when Cozy, the musk ox, was separated from his herd. He was used to being with his family. His mother and father had named him Cozy because his silky coat was so soft and thick. Cozy braced himself against the wind, and his thick coat warmed him like a blanket. In a tussock, a mother lemming's pups were squeaking loudly. "I'm cold, I'm cold, I'm cold." She used a triple carry to tunnel them toward a new spot, where she saw a towering mountain of fur. In no time, the lemming family settled in next to Cozy's left hoof. "Shh," she whispered, "quiet voices, and that musk ox will never notice us." Snowshoe Hare, feeling chilly, had the same idea. "Master Musk Ox," he asked politely, "may I wait out the storm under the protection of your very thick coat?" Cozy was happy for the company and well aware that a lemming family had snuck in. He said, "Welcome, Snowshoe Hare, but mind those lemmings, quiet voices, and gentle thumping only." Snow swirled and flump, suddenly all grew white. Was it a clump of snow that had hit Cozy on the forehead? No, it was feathers. When Cozy opened his eyes, he was looking into big yellow ones. The eyes belonged to a snowy owl, who also had a request. "Oh, magnificent Omemak, would you be so kind as to give me shelter? The wind has tumbled me terribly." Cozy knew that snowy owls and lemmings and snowshoe hares were not always fast friends, but he agreed with some conditions. House rules are quiet voices, gentle thumping, claws to yourself. Arctic Fox's nose was turning blue. Her bushy tail wasn't warm enough, and every time she wrapped it around herself, the wind unwrapped it. Thinking Cozy would make a good windbreak, she sidled up to him. "Do you mind, Mr. Musk Ox, if I unfreeze my nose in your thick fluff?" Cozy was happy to welcome a new guest, but eyeing her sharp canines, he answered, "For the harmony of all, quiet voices, gentle thumping, claws to yourself, and no biting." As winter went by, the storms grew worse. The wind blew and blew, and a low, humpy shape appeared, swaying and shuffling its coat and covered with ice balls. "Shaggy beast," it growled. "I fell into an ice floe and am chilled to the bone. Can you help me?" Cozy was happy to invite the Wolverine in, but added to the house rules. Quiet voices, gentle thumping, claws to yourself, no biting, and no pouncing. Cozy's new friends cleaned their coats, preened their feathers, napped, and were glad for their comfy shelter. But then, above the wind, the animals heard, yip, yip, yip. A team of huskies, always on the lookout for a good thing, barreled into Cozy's big bulk, flinging the creatures in all directions. Their musher, a sea otter, looked on in dismay. Hi, the lead dog grinned. House rules, chorused the jostled lemmings, snowshoe hare, snowy owl, arctic fox, and wolverine. Quiet voices, gentle thumping, claws to yourself, no biting, no pouncing, and be mindful of others. Cozy, wary of the lead dog, who looked a lot like a wolf, shook his horns to make sure the huskies understood. As time went by, the wind calmed a little, and the Arctic sun climbed higher in the sky. The animals felt more at home every day. But Cozy had spring fever. I want to find my family. How can I move about with these visitors underfoot? The house rules were stretched every day. When was a nibble a bite? When was a hoot quiet or loud? There was bumping, making faces, and nobody was saying, I'm sorry. One sunny day, the lemmings were playing climb the ladder. A great chunk of Cozy's coat came off. Then another, Hank, came off in snowy owl's talons. Cozy remembered this from last year. Shedding meant it was finally spring in Alaska. Hank by Hank, all of Cozy's warm, silky winter coat drifted down the slope. Cozy's lodgers started heading to their spring homes. Cozy hadn't felt so free and breezy since he was a calf. He jumped, he gambolled, and then, in the middle of a gleeful leap, he saw his herd. He ran to join his mother, his father, his sister, and his brother. Where were you? We were worried, said his sister, Fluffy. We missed you, said his brother, Snuggly. I made some new friends, Cozy had told them, but it was nice to get back to musk ox ways. They all formed a circle, babies in the middle, but Cozy felt curiously alone. Then the breeze carried squeaky and growly and whistling voices. See you next year, Cozy. Meet you when the snow flies, Cozy. The snowshoe hare thump, thump, thumped, as they all called. We can't wait to get cozy with Cozy. Auntie Maggie and her five nephews and nieces. Like every other summer morning, Auntie Maggie set off for the swimming pool with her nephews and nieces, Timmy, Tammy, Tommy, Tummy, and Temmy. They spent the whole year waiting for summer to come so they could all enjoy these special days together. Auntie Maggie was always the first one to get into the pool. Timmy, Tammy, Tommy, Tummy, and Temmy usually took a little longer. Timmy was the first of the children to reach the pool. Just as he was about to dive in, he said, "Oh no, I didn't bring my diving goggles." And so he jumped right onto Auntie Maggie's back so the water wouldn't get into his eyes. Tammy was the second of the children to reach the pool. Just as she was about to dive in, she said, "Oh no, I forgot to bring my water wings." And so she landed right on Auntie Maggie's back so she wouldn't swallow any water. Tommy was third of the children to reach the pool. Just as he was about to dive in, he said, "Oh no, I forgot to put on sunscreen." And so he jumped right onto Auntie Maggie's back in the shadow of his brother and sister. Timmy was the fourth of the children to reach the pool. Just as he was about to dive in, he said, "Oh no, I forgot to put on bug spray." Realizing he was surrounded by wasps, he jumped right onto Auntie Maggie's head. Tummy was the fifth of the children to reach the pool. Just as she was diving in, she said, "Oh no, I forgot." It was a joke. She hadn't really forgotten anything. She just thought it would be fun to go along with her brothers and sisters. After Tummy jumped in, Auntie Maggie and her five nephews and nieces began to sink to the bottom of the pool. She couldn't support the weight of all the children's problems. She had to do something. At home, while they were having a snack, she looked at Tummy, Timmy, Tommy, Tammy, and Timmy. "You know, things around here have got to change. Your Auntie Maggie isn't a life jacket," she said in a serious voice. And so they got to work. Auntie Maggie taught Timmy to make lists of things that he should not forget before entering the pool, including the diving goggles. Auntie Maggie taught Tammy to swim, so there wouldn't be a problem if she forgot her water wings again. Auntie Maggie taught Tommy to squeeze out just the right amount of sunscreen so it would cover his whole body. Auntie Maggie taught Timmy to not be afraid of bugs. "If we just leave them alone, the wasps won't sting us," she said. Auntie Maggie taught Tummy. She was only joking. She didn't have to teach Tummy anything, because Tummy enjoyed just being with her brothers and sisters and her aunt every day. That day, they all understood that it was easier to try to fix problems than to keep carrying them around with you, because they can often end up making you sink. Auntie Maggie's five nephews and nieces began to ask her for help only when things got really complicated. And she couldn't have been happier. The first night of Howler Garden. Welcome to Howler Garden. Your first night of Howler Garden will be full of furry fun wear activities, and you'll meet many new friends. Most importantly, when the full moon rises, our students will transform into their true wear selves for the first time. We can't wait to celebrate with you. "Do I have to go to Howler Garden?" asked Sophie. "What if I don't transform into a werewolf like you and Dad?" "You'll be your wonderful self." "And that's already enough," Mom replied. "Don't worry. We'll always love you, no matter who you are," said Dad. But Sophie did not want to remain human. She had heard from Molly, a first grader, that her friend's cousin's brother failed to become a werewolf on his first full moon. Rumor had it he got kicked out of Howler Garden. Sophie did not want to be alone. She wanted to be part of a pack. She's still human. So she gathered all her werewolf things, put on her favorite werewolf headband, and repeated werewolf thoughts to herself. "I'm a howler. I'll have fur. I'll have fangs and a bushy tail." Sophie felt ready for school. Until the first bell rang. "Good evening, Sophie," said her teacher. "Ready to join our pack?" Sophie whimpered. "We'll be back soon," said Mom. "You've got this," said Dad. Sophie looked at all the new faces. Her tummy gurgled. Then she overheard one of her classmates, a girl named Emma. "I'm not afraid. I'll definitely transform. I'm told I'm the best tracker in my family." Sophie was worried. She knew a strong sense of smell was a sign that you might turn into a werewolf, but she hadn't ever tried tracking anything. First, they practiced how to move like a wolf. Gallop, trot, pounce. Sophie stumbled. Next, they learned to listen to the whispers of the wind. Sophie strained her ears, but heard no howls. Then they tried to track. Sophie never caught a scent. Achoo! She wished she was more like Emma, who found her bone right away. Sophie seemed to lack basic werewolf skills. Was this a sign she would stay human? At recess, Sophie snuck away. She knew the other kids would never accept a human as part of their pack. Then she heard a sniffle. Did Teddy feel the same way? "Want to share my wolfy grams?" Sophie asked. "My favorite," Teddy replied. "Thank you." Then Emma found them. "Is that Vicky Fang?" she asked. "Look, I have Lola Fang." "Can I play too?" Randall asked as he trotted over. Maybe Howler Garden wasn't so bad. Maybe they'd all still like her, even if she stayed human. After recess, Sophie and her new friends continued to train. She might not have basic werewolf skills, but with a little help, she caught on fast. "Found it!" She's holding up a bone. After all the activities, it was time to rest. But it wasn't long before the clouds parted and the full moon appeared. "It's your moment, Howler Gardeners," her teacher announced. "On the count of three, lift your face to the moon and call your were-self. 1, 2, 3. All of Sophie's fears came rushing back. Her heart pounded as she counted 1. Then Teddy reached over and held her hand, 2. Sophie decided she was ready, 3, to remain human, if that was her fate. Sophie opened her eyes. She glanced at a mirror. Instead of 2 human hands, she saw 2 soft padded paws, a short snout, and a bushy tail. Sophie looked around and discovered that Teddy had changed too. And so had the others. They had done it. They were werewolves. But then she heard a sniffle. Emma was crying in the corner. She was still human. As Sophie approached her, Emma said, "Now I can't be part of the pack. I'm not one of you." Sophie placed her paws on Emma's hands. "Human or werewolf, we are always a pack, and nothing will ever change that." Together, they trotted and they tracked. They perked up their ears to the wind and they pounced. And Sophie and her friends howled and growled until the last bell rang. Mama's sleeping scarf. Mama's scarf is green. It has big red circles and little blue circles. Chino likes to trace the circles with her finger. First, the big red circles, then the little blue circles. Chino likes to touch Mama's scarf because it's so silky and soft. Every night before bed, Mama ties her scarf around her head to keep her hair all soft and nice. "Mama is wearing the hat," Bunny says in her secret voice. "No, silly, it's not a hat, it's a scarf." "It's Mama's sleeping scarf," Chino says. "A sleeping scarf?" Bunny asks. "Yes, it keeps Mama's hair all soft and nice." It's morning and Mama is brushing her teeth. "Are you going out, Mama?" Chino asks. "Yes, Chino, I'm going to work." "Will you come back?" "Yes, I'll come back. I always come back." "What if you don't come back?" "I'll always come back, Chino." "I have an idea. Would you like to play with Mama's scarf until I come back?" "Yes, please." Chino pulls Mama's scarf off her head. It goes, "Whee!" Time to play with Mama's scarf. Bunny is sitting on a chair. Bunny is gray with long droopy ears. "I have an idea, Bunny," Chino says. "The scarf can be your pretend blanket." "Good idea," Bunny says in her secret voice. Chino wraps Bunny in Mama's scarf to keep Bunny all warm and nice. I like the big blue circles, Bunny says in her secret voice. No, silly, they are big red circles, Chino says. Oh, yes, big red circles. Papa is making a smoothie in the kitchen with fresh fruits all sweet and nice, yellow bananas and green mangoes. Chino peeks out from behind the scarf. Peekaboo, I see you, Papa. I see you, Chino, Papa says. Would you like a taste of my smoothie? Yes, please. Chino takes a sip from Papa's cup. Oops, we've made a little mess on Mama's scarf. Papa cleans up the spill with a towel. Dab, dab, dab goes Papa. Now, Mama's scarf is clean and nice again. Grandpa is taking a walk in the garden. He walks in circles, round and round. He gets his exercise so he can be nice and strong. Chino waves the scarf in the air. It goes, "Whee! Look, Grandpa, I see you." "I see you too, Chino," Grandpa says. "Would you like to exercise with me?" "Yes, please." "But I can't exercise," Bunny says in her secret voice. "Yes, you can, silly," Chino says. Chino runs around in the garden holding the scarf. Bunny runs too. And whee goes the scarf in the wind. Grandma is reading the newspaper. Her glasses are big and round like circles. Chino hides her face behind the scarf. "Do you see me, Grandma? I see you." "Oh, I can't see you, Chino," Grandma says. Chino peeks out from behind the scarf. "Now I see you," Grandma says. "Would you like me to tie the scarf around your head, Chino?" "Yes, please. Now you look just like Mama." "Can I try Mama's scarf on my head too?" Bunny asks in her secret voice. "No, Bunny, because your head is too little," Chino says. Chino gives Mama a nice big hug, and Papa gives Mama a nice big hug. "Did Papa tie my scarf around your head, Chino?" "No, Grandma did." "Oh, it looks so nice on you," Mama says. It's dinner time. "Can I wear the scarf at dinner, please?" Chino asks. "Yes, Chino," Mama says, "but when it's bedtime, I'll need it for my hair." Papa has made some chicken, vegetables, and rice for dinner. "Would you like some vegetables, Chino?" Grandma asks. "No, thank you. Vegetables don't taste nice," Chino says. "Oh, some vegetables taste nice. You can try a little bit and see," Grandpa says. "Look, Chino, the vegetables are green, just like Mama's scarf is green," Papa says. "And the tomatoes are red, just like the red circles on Mama's scarf." "Would you like to try just a little bit of the vegetables, Chino?" Mama asks. "Maybe just a little bit," Chino says. Chino eats a little bit of vegetables and a little bit of rice and a little bit of chicken, and then she eats a little bit of tomatoes. "Thank you for making a nice dinner, Papa," Chino says. "I liked eating a little bit of the green vegetables. And I'd like to eat a little bit of the green scarf," Bunny says in her secret voice. "No, you can't eat the scarf, silly," Chino says. "A vegetable is food, but a scarf isn't food." Now it's time to go to bed. Here comes Mama looking for her scarf. Mama's sleeping scarf is so silky and soft. She pulls it off Chino's head, and it goes, "Whee!" when Mama pulls it off. Mama ties her scarf around her head. "Are you sleepy, Chino?" Mama asks. "Yes," Chino says. "I'm not sleepy," Bunny says in her secret voice. "Yes, you are, silly, because it's bedtime," Chino says. Chino gives Bunny a nice big hug. "Good night, Bunny. Good night, Mama. Good night, Papa. Good night, Scarf." Angela's Glacier. This is Angela's Glacier. For weeks before Angela arrived, her glacier was covered in clouds. And then Angela came into the world and the glacier bloomed. Peacock indigo and duck egg blue. Under the milky Arctic sunlight, Angela's father held her in his arms carefully, like a fragile icicle, wrapped her in a blanket, and took her outside into the cold air. Turning Angela to see the glacier in the distance, her father said, "The glacier came out just for you." Angela's father felt her heart beat faster in the winter air. "I will take you there," he said. And they both listened to the whispers of ancient ice fill Angela's birthday morning. Before Angela learned to walk, her father carried her on his back through lava fields covered with silver mosses, past chocolate brown Arctic foxes, atop raven's glass, crowberry, and pixie lichen. They walked through snowfields thick like pancakes to the glacier's ice blue heart. Angela listened to the glacier. Her father held her still in this universe of sound. Day after day, month after month, Angela's father carried her to this place. As her father hiked, with every step he took, he taught Angela how to speak the glacier's name. Skephelis Jokolo. Snay, left foot, fells, right foot. Snay, left foot, fells, right foot. Snay, left foot, fells, right foot. Joe, left foot, cull, right foot. Joe, left foot, cull, right foot. Joe, left foot, cull, right foot. Snay, fells, Joe, cull. Snay, fells, Joe, cull. Snay, fells, Joe, cull. As Angela grew, she started walking up the glacier by herself. And day after day, month after month, year after year, Angela went to her glacier to feel and listen. She listened to the temperature. She listened to the colors. She listened to wind and water play together in the snow. Angela took her hands out of her mittens and touched the cold ice, keeping her fingers there for as long as she could. She rubbed her hands up and down the bumps and cracks of the glacier's skin and pressed her ear to the ice and listened. Angela let the glacier listen to her too. She'd whisper about what scared her, like owls and falling off her bike. And she'd whisper about how much she missed her dad when he left for work each day. Angela grew up with Snake Fell Joe Cull. But she grew older. Life got really busy. Angela walked away from her glacier. She spent her days like this. School, friends, violin, soccer, bike rides, homework. Time just melted away. Every night, Angela put her hand over her heart and listened carefully. She didn't know why it sounded strange. So she asked her father, "Have you visited Snay Fells Joe Cull?" Her father asked. Angela had not. Not for a long, long time. So she packed her bags with a bottle of water, an extra sweater, and some snacks, and up she went to that ancient blue, Snay Fells Joe Cull. Snay Fells Joe Cull. Snay Fells Joe Cull. Snay Fells Joe Cull. and it shows her laying down and on top of the glacier, hugging it. She wondered if Snowfell Jaycall could hear her. Could the glacier feel her touch? Angela knew she couldn't stop growing up. She knew her life would only get busier. But instead of walking away, Angela got really close to that coldest of cold and whispered her promise into that old ice. I will always visit. I will always listen. That night, Angela lay in bed and put her hand over her heart. This is the sound of Angela's heart. Snowfell Jaycall. Snowfell Jaycall. Snowfell Jaycall. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm possibly going to finish the novel that I've been reading now for a little over 3 months, titled Ringer. In Palmer LaRue's hometown of Weymouth, turning 10 is the biggest event of a boy's life. But for Palmer, his 10th birthday is not something to look forward to, but something to dread. Then one day, a visitor appears on his windowsill, and Palmer knows that this, more than anything else, is a sign that his time is up. Somehow, he must learn how to stop being afraid and stand up for what he believes in. Okay, last week, Dorothy agreed to take Nipper on a family vacation to try to get rid of him. Henry, whose real name is George, inspected Palmer's room for Ringer and found nothing. Palmer no longer had Ringer, Dorothy, or his gang of friends. During family fest, Palmer noticed that the golden bird in his house was removed from their mantle. Palmer is now watching the pigeon shoot and describing how 5,000 pigeons are shot. Once every 4 or 5 bockfuls, a pigeon got away clean. Missed entirely by the buckshot, it flew over the reaching arms of the crowd and into the sky, circled the field several times, and was gone. On the table by the scorekeeper stood a golden bird, this year's sharpshooter award. The ringers had learned their jobs well. At the feet of the pink-hated ringmaster, they crouched like sprinters, counting 5 shots. They sprang onto the field 3 at a time, one with a new loaded box, the other 2 after downed pigeons. They did not ring the necks of the wounded in the field, for that would waste time, and the ringmaster was holding a stopwatch and calling the seconds. They dashed back with both living and dead swinging in their fist. Some held the birds by the neck, some by their feet. Some ringers wore wristbands. The ringing was done on the sidelines. The dead birds dropped into large, dark green trash bags. Palmer noticed that Beans, Mutto, and Henry always worked as a threesome. Their turn came about every 15 minutes. They never rotated jobs. Henry always did the boxes. When the sun had cleared the tallest trees, Palmer felt a hand squeeze his little finger. It was Dorothy. "Did you eat?" she said. "Your mother said you didn't eat breakfast." "I'm not hungry," he said. They both looked ahead at the shooting field as they spoke. Dorothy did not let go of his finger. With every boom of a shotgun, he felt her flinch. At every neck ringing, she squeezed his finger. He could hear her breathing. Though he had seen little of Dorothy since she returned from her vacation 3 weeks before, he was not surprised that she was beside him now. Through most of the morning, it had been a relief to Palmer to see that he was ignored by Beans and Mutto. Sometimes the pursuit of a flopper brought one of them within 10 feet of where he stood. But they went about their business of snatch and dash and never seemed to notice him until now. This time, when Bean snatched a wounded bird flopping in the grass, instead of heading straight back to the ringmaster, he detoured over to Palmer, his teeth even yellower in the sun, his eyes wild with glee. He thrust the pigeon before Palmer's face, and then Dorothy's, and, as he had so often pretended, wrung its neck. The bird's orange button eye blinked. Dorothy's eyes were shut. She backed away. "I have to go." Palmer caught her by the arm. "Wait!" They stood staring at each other's face, the only place their eyes were safe. Double-barreled booms and laughter mingled with smells of mustard and onions and barbecue and gun smoke. He could not wait any longer to ask, "Where did you let him go?" "Nipper?" she asked, as if she didn't know. "Yeah, where?" "In the city." Palmer was puzzled. "The city? I thought you went to the shore." He had pictured Dorothy standing on a boardwalk or beach, tossing Nipper into the air. Nipper soaring over the sand, the foaming surf, he imagined a pigeon would have a good life at the seashore. "We did," she said. She was not making this easy. "But you just said the city." "Well, we stopped off in the city." A boom, she flinched. "For a day." He remembered his trip to the city 2 years before, his delight in the pedestrian pigeons strolling, nodding up and down the sidewalks, right along with the people. That, too, now that he thought about it, seemed like a good life for a pigeon. He nodded. "City, huh?" She nodded. "Did you, like, reach up and throw him into the air and he flew away?" He wanted a clear picture to remember. "Or did you let him down on the sidewalk?" And he walked along with the people. She twitched at a gun boom. She took a step back. "No, none of that. I rolled down the car window and he flew out." It wasn't how Palmer would have wished. "While you were driving or stopped?" "Stopped." "In the traffic? Downtown? Where?" Still trying to picture it. Another gun boom. She shivered as if it were December and not August. "At the railroad yards." "Railroad yards." Palmer grabbed her by both arms and squeezed. "What?" She squirmed. "What, what?" "Did you say railroad yards?" "Yes, stop it." She twisted away from him and ran back through the people. Palmer caught her at the back of the crowd. He planted himself in front of her. She sneered. "Tree stumping again?" "Dorothy," he was screeching, "you let him out at the railroad yards." Dorothy threw up her hands. "So? So? The railroad yards are where they go to trap pigeons and bring them here. Why did you have to let him go there?" A boom was followed by a second, louder explosion of cheers and howling laughter. Something outrageous had happened. Dorothy stared, stunned, at Palmer. Her lips quivered. "We don't know about that stuff. Nobody ever told us that. Nobody in my family shoots pigeons," she was screaming. Heads turned. Dorothy ran off. This time, Palmer did not follow. In the final chapter, chapter 40, he knew how it will end. He can see it, his bird terrified in the smothering darkness of the box. It's like a coffin when suddenly one wall springs up and light pours in and he's free to go. He steps out onto grass and feathers, thinking, "Hey, where's the bedroom?" He takes another step, looks around. There are people, people everywhere, more people than he has ever seen. But he is not afraid. The people he has known, the boy and the girl, were always good to him. He almost thinks of them as pigeons. He wonders if they... The blast knocks him off his feet. drives him sideways like the other blizzard long ago. There is pain in his wing. It drags. It will not move. He cannot stand straight or walk right. He tries to fly, but labors only inches into the gray, sour cloud and flops back to earth. The people are noisy. The people are laughing and cheering and whistling. They are happy. He has never seen so many happy people. He wobbles toward them. He wants to be with them, with all those happy faces. And then he sees that one face is different. One face is not laughing. It is not happy. He knows the face. He would know it anywhere. Dragging his wing through the feathers that cover the ground, he heads for the face. He is limping toward the face when the second blast comes. He whispered, "Nipper, Nipper." At the old train station on Friday, a swelling gobble of noise had come from the crates. Here they were silent. If Palmer had not known better, he would never have believed there were thousands of pigeons behind the wooden slats. "Nipper, Nipper," he whispered into the crates. He stood on tiptoes and crawled on hands and knees, peering into the dark streps of space between the slats. Orange eyes flashed in the dark. He could not hope to reach the ones on top. "Nipper!" Nipper was here, he knew it, somewhere in the canyon wall of crates, towering above him, unless he was already shot. "Nipper! Hey, kid!" A workman coming around the corner pointing. "Let's go, move it. You can't be back here. Out with everybody else." Palmer thrust a hand as far as it would go into one of the spaces. He wiggled his fingers, feeling only darkness. The man was coming. "Kid, now!" Summer has nearly 2 months to run, but the shooting field, covered in feathers, has a look of gray, demented autumn. A man with a bamboo rake pulls shotgun shells into piles. The mound of green plastic bags grows taller than the ringmaster's neon pink cap. Sometimes a bulge of plastic moves. The line of shooters is never more than 7 or 8 deep, yet it never ends. The golden pigeon never blinks. People point hot dogs at wounded, scurrying birds, yelling to ringers, "There, there!" The boxmaster makes a mistake. He opens 2 hatches at once. Out fly a pair of pigeons. Boom! Knocked from the air with 1 shot. A double kill. A rare deuce. 4 points. The crowd goes wild. The biggest cheer of all goes to a yellow cat, which streaks onto the field, snatches a wounded bird, and streaks off into the trees. Gun smoke and afternoon sunlight. Someone tosses a frisbee onto the field. The shooter on line fires. The frisbee lurches and falls. A ringer dashes out, snatches the disc, and pretends to strangle it. The ringmaster laughs. The crowd howls. The scorekeeper maintains a stern face, disqualifies the shooter. People come and go, changing the composition, but not the shape of the crowd. Only Palmer stays through it all. Sun smoke. Palmer cursed the sameness of the pigeons. Some of them had dark feathers, charcoal, and as they exploded on the ground and in the air, Palmer thanked them for so clearly not being Nipper. But 3 out of 4 birds that walked out of the white box looked just like his. Gunsmoke gray. Nipper had no special markings, nor had Palmer ever thought to fix a band to his bird's leg or neck. For he knew without reading a book that of boys and pigeons, it is the boy who, so to speak, wears the collar, that it is never the pigeon, but the boy who is lost. Not knowing which gray-feathered bird might be Nipper, Palmer believed that everyone was. Over and over, 1,000 times, he was sure he saw Nipper killed. 1,000 times he felt the sting of the buckshot. 1,000 times he saw Nipper's neck wrung. Occasionally, a pigeon flapped into the air and stayed there, feathers intact, not only stayed there, but rose higher and higher into the gray cloud. Then above it, above the treetops, into the sky, a miracle. As the birds circled the field, Palmer silently celebrated, his shoulders shrugging up and down in support of the wonderfully working, unshot wings. Around him, people shot their fists at the sky and cursed. Others cheered the bird, toasted it with bottles of soda pop hoisted high. Still others jeered the not-so-sharp shooter. Eventually, each miracle bird flew out of sight, and each time Palmer whispered, "Let it be Nipper," then he would hear the next gun boom. He would see ringers galloping through the feather fall. He would see the swollen plastic bags across the way, gorged on pigeon corpses. And for an unspeakable moment, he would be inside in a stinking muggery of limp necks and orange eyes dead as buttons. And he was sure that his bird was one of them. Fertilizer. It did not occur to Palmer that he had not eaten all day until a crew-cut little kid with a cup of grape water ice stood beside him. The little kid mimicked every gun boom by pointing a purple-stained forefinger and barking, "Pow! Pow!" While an empty white box was being replaced by a loaded one, the little kid looked up at Palmer and said, "Are you a ringer?" "Do I look like it?" Palmer replied, not wanting to be bothered, and already not liking this kid. The kid was untouched by Palmer's sarcasm. "How old are you?" he said. 25, said Palmer. The dumb kid continued to stare up at Palmer as he slurped his water ice. "I'm 7. "Hooray." In 3 years, he held up 3 purple fingers. "I'm going to be 10. And then, boom, the first bird emerged from the freshly stocked white box, new shooters shooting. The kid swung and pointed, "Pow, pow," and kept jabbering at Palmer. "And then I'll be, boom, pow, a ringer. I'm going to ring there." He tried to show what he would do, but spilled purple slush over his own wrist. "Boom. Pow, pow, I'm going to ring more than anybody. I'm going to boom. Pow, I'm going to." Palmer was no longer hearing the yammering kid. He was looking up. The second pigeon out of the box had been another Nipper lookalike. It took a few casual steps and stopped to peck at the ground. A perfect target. Incredibly, the shooter had missed. The pigeon had taken off and was now higher than the afternoon sun. Another rare one, a miracle bird. Blocking the sun with his fist, Palmer watched the bird circle the field, as the others had done. Palmer's shoulder muscle flexed to the rhythm of its wings, urging it on. It circled a fourth time, and again it was not leaving. It was simply circling. In fact, impossibly, it seemed to be getting closer. It was Nipper. Palmer simply and suddenly knew it. And just as suddenly, the horror of what he was doing struck him. For if Nipper truly was searching for him and found him, Palmer's own stupid, unthinking, upturned face was nothing more than bait luring his pigeon back to a second chance at death. This time, the shooter would not miss. Palmer covered his face with his hands. "No," he prayed. "No, no, no." Too late. As the bird broke from its circle and began its long downward swing, the little kid beside Palmer pointed and screamed, "Look, It's coming back! It's coming back! Palmer knocked the water ice from the kid's hand as the people began to look up. Fingers pointed, more faces turned. The shooter, who had been walking away, stopped and turned. His hand dipped into the pocket of his vest. The only sound was the outraged howl of the purple plastered kid. Palmer stepped away from the people then, into the clear, onto the shooting field, the better to be seen. For he knew now that there was no stopping it. Downward came the bird, lazily looping through the haze, gray in gray descending, gliding, a summer sledder down a slope of sun smoke, and landed on Palmer's head. At that point, even the howling kid shut up. His boggling eyes joined the townful of others, aimed at a spot just above Palmer's forehead. Nipper's toes clutched and moved on his scalp, and for a strangely wonderful moment, he felt himself crowned. The shooter was slipping shells into the twin barrel of his gun, and suddenly out of nowhere, there was Beans swiping at Palmer's head, even as Nipper chuckled, sending the pigeon to the ground. Before Palmer could react, Beans was on the bird, scooping it up and sprinting to the center of the field. He hoisted the bird above his head and gave a long, ripping screech of triumph. He ran to the shooter, who stood stone-faced at the chalk line, shotgun at the ready. Mashing its wings, Beans took the bird in the shooter's face. "It's yours! It came back! Kill! Kill!" He slammed the bird to the ground and ran for cover. Palmer was running too. He saw the shooter shoulder his gun. His scream, "No!" made a puff in the gun smoke cloud. He splashed through the fallen feathers, which were deepest here, in the territory between the shooter and the white box. Like October leaves, he plunged face first, landing, sliding through the gray softness into his hobbly, wobbling bird. He pulled it into himself, curled himself around it. The comical, many-voiced, eight-toed friend blizzard-blown into his life one day. He closed his eyes and buried his face in the bed of feathers and waited for the shot, the boom. He waited and waited and heard only silence. He dared to lift his head and look around. The ringmaster was holding one arm out, making a gate behind, which the ringers gaped. The ringmaster's other hand had Beans by the collar. The shotgun stood on its heel at attention. Palmer got to his feet. He ignored the blood, tacky feathers sticking to his face. He held Nipper close. Standing there and feathers up, to his sneaker knots, Palmer felt a peace, a lightness that he had never known before, as if restraining straps had snapped, setting him free to float upward. For a moment, feeling in his fingertips the quick beating of Nipper's acorn-sized heart, he believed he could fly. Through a pigeon's eye, he looked down from the sky upon the field, the thousands of upturned faces, and saw nothing at all to fear. He reached out then, held his pigeon out to the people, slowly turned so they could all see, so they all would know. Someone whistled, someone shouted, bang, and laughter followed. People booed. Cradling his pigeon in both hands, Palmer walked from the field. The crowd parted just enough to let him through. He felt the cold stares of the people. He smelled the mustard on their breaths. A hand reached out. He flinched. It was a little hand, a child's hand, touching Nipper's wing, stroking it. A child's voice saying, "Can I have one too, Daddy?" And here's a newspaper article. Waymer, the annual Pigeon Day shoot held here on Saturday was declared a rousing success by the event's organizers. More than 300 sharpshooters, not all of them so sharp, quipped one official, took aim on some 5,000 birds released on the Memorial Park soccer field. Proceeds from shoot entry fees plus revenues from the week-long family fest netted the community almost $34,000 for maintaining its park. An unexpected episode occurred during this year's event. At one point in the late afternoon, an unidentified boy dashed onto the shooting field and retrieved a wounded pigeon. Shooting was immediately halted, and the reckless lad, perhaps seeking an unusual pet for himself, was allowed to leave the premise with the bird. Certainly, that lucky pigeon had not fallen under the aim of Howard Eckert. Eckert, 36, a dairyman from Harmony Farms, won this year's Sharpshooters Trophy as Best Marksman. Said Eckert, "Anybody can hit a clay pigeon. These babies, you never know which way." And that concludes the book Ringer by Jerry Spinelli. And once again, that's all the time that we have for today. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I begin a brand new novel. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.